call my name. It makes me feel so ashamed. I've lost my sweet heavenly man. I've got myself to blame. One night with you is what I'm now praying for. The things I did and I saw make the earth stand still.
Gotta work like a slave all day. And then comes Tuesday. Oh my Tuesday. I've got no time to play. Wednesday morning I am beating my socks, so I can do just a punch a clock. Thursday it's a hard working day, and Friday I get my pay. Saturday morning, oh Saturday morning, all of my tires gone away. I've got my money, I've got my honey, and I'm out on the town to play. Sunday morning, I'm feeling bad, but it was worth it for the time that I had. Sunday, better get my rest, 'cause Monday is a mess.
Mountain. I'm tired of being alone, so come on home, come on home. I'm gonna hug her tight, because you know it's been so long. I'm gonna hug her tight, because you know it's been so long. I've climbed the highest mountain, I'm tired of being alone, so come on home, come on home. I'm just a poor fella, falling my bow out around. My baby's coming back, so get yourself another clown. I'm gonna jump and shout, because my baby's coming home. I climbed the highest mountain, I'm tired of being alone, so come on home, come on home. Huh.
DJ Heim from Forest, and you're listening to 88.3 WRCT.
This morning we woke up to what was reported as a shocking number, 33%. 33% approval for President Joe Biden, a disastrously low number. And the number is true, but we're going to contextualize it. It's just one poll. And while overall Joe Biden's approval is not great, it's still better than Trump's was at this point in time in Trump's presidency. So without context, the 33% number is not worth that much, but it is not a good number. So let's start with that 33% number. We have a new Quinnipiac poll. And indeed, the poll finds, and Quinnipiac is a good pollster, that only 33% of Americans approve of the way that Joe Biden is handling his job. This is a tie for the low ever received by Biden in this poll with January 12th, when it was also 33%. Now, the main question for me is, why is it low and what could raise it? Really the key two questions with any presidential approval poll. But then we're also going to compare it to other approval polls. So looking at the Quinnipiac poll, we find that only 39% of Americans approve of Joe Biden's handling of the response to the Russian invasion of Ukraine. 39%. That's a much lower number than we saw weeks ago in other polls. Now, part of it could be the way the poll is done, and part of it likely is a decline in approval of how Joe Biden has handled that situation. Interestingly, more than 8 in 10 Americans believe Russian President Vladimir Putin is a war criminal, something that Donald Trump hesitates to say, and we will get to that a little bit later. 10% believe Putin is not a war criminal. 7 in 10 think Putin ordered Russian troops to kill civilians in Ukraine. 14% think that he did not. So this is the Quinnipiac poll. Well, what about more generally speaking? What's going on with Joe Biden's approval? Well, for that, one of the best places to look is the 538 Biden approval, which looks at an average of recent approval polls. And when we look there, we find that it's not as bad for Joe Biden. Certainly, it's not good. And as you can see, early in his presidency, Joe Biden in the mid-50s in terms of approval, then moving into the low 50s, crossing below the 50% line, getting down into the mid-40s, and then into the low 40s. And most recently, we see this little decline from about 42 to 41. If you look more deeply at the specific polls making that up, and this is where we would say, okay, where does the Quinnipiac poll fit into this? We see that this recent Quinnipiac University poll is here, which has Joe Biden at 33. That is an outlier in the sense that all of the other recent polls have Joe Biden between 38 and 44. Does that mean the Quinnipiac poll is wrong? Well, no, it doesn't mean it's wrong, but it does mean it is sort of an outlier. And when 538 applies what they call an adjustment, the 33 becomes 37. So needless to say, this is not a good situation for Joe Biden. And the question now is going to be, well, what needs to happen for that to change? Because these are not great numbers. The next question would be, are these guaranteed to be destructive numbers looking forward at the midterms and potentially at 2024? Well, one thing we can look at there is how does the current Biden approval, 41 point something, how does that compare with other presidents at this point in their presidencies? If you look at Biden versus Trump, you find that at this point in time, Trump actually was at 40.6. I mean, it's more or less the same, but Biden's approval today is slightly better than was Trump's at this point in his presidency. If you compare Biden to basically any other recent president, you see that Barack Obama had a higher approval at this point in time. George W. Bush had a dramatically higher approval, thanks to 9/11. Bill Clinton had a higher approval than Biden. George H.W. Bush had a much higher approval than Biden. Reagan had a higher approval than Biden. You have to go all the way back to Jimmy Carter to even get close. And even then, just at this time, Carter also did better than Biden, but soon Jimmy Carter started seeing a reduction. What does this mean for 2022? It's not good. It's not good. There's really no way to spin it that feels empirically honest. And I know that you're going to see hot takes from Democratic pollsters and operatives and analysts that are saying, well, listen, the midterms are not necessarily a referendum on Biden and XYZ, but if this doesn't change, it's going to be a disaster for Democrats. There's just no way around it. It is going to be potentially one of the worst midterms for Democrats in a very long time. Now, what could change it? Many things could change it. If the American perception of the economy improves between now and November, it's good for Democrats. And I know many of you will say, but David, the numbers are good for the economy. You're absolutely right. But we did a story early last week about the difference between an economic reality and a political reality. Jobs numbers are dramatically better now than when Joe Biden took over. But a third of the country doesn't think so. A third of the country thinks jobs have been lost. I know we can say, oh, those stupid. If that's what they believe, they're going to vote on that basis. And so what matters is what people believe. Some kind of satisfactory resolution in Ukraine, and it's hard to use that language given the death and destruction that's been seen there. Some kind of politically satisfactory resolution will likely be helpful to Democrats, because I believe that the midterms are a referendum on Joe Biden. I think there's no way to argue that they are not. But not good numbers for Joe Biden. And if nothing changes, that's the key. If nothing changes, it will be a disastrous midterm for Democrats. If you disagree with me, let me know. Tell me how the current numbers translate to an okay midterm for Democrats. I just don't see it. I want to look at a very disturbing video. Not disturbing in the sense that it's gory. Not disturbing in the sense that there's bad words, swears, as we might say. It's disturbing because it is another one of these examples of how conspiracy theories rarely live alone in someone's brain. And we talked about this with Dr. Stephen Novella earlier in the week, and we've talked about this with other experts on conspiratorial thinking. We say, well, flat Earth, it's so benign. Okay, you think the Earth is flat, but that's it. Doesn't mean, well, no. Typically, these conspiratorial beliefs come in groups. And an attendee at a Chuck Grassley town hall said, Putin's not bad because he's fighting Nazis. And what about the Ukrainian biolabs and the pedophilia, and there's deep state corruption in Ukraine? And it's emblematic of how it's never just one conspiracy theory. And maybe just as disturbing is that Chuck Grassley doesn't seem to push back against any of these. Take a look at this. This is what America has become. Half of America.
And on what you know about biolabs, the financing that Putin has stopped over in Ukraine, the Nazis, and the pedophilia that goes on in Ukraine.
By the way, pedophilia, I just love that. Not only are they often confused by the conspiracies, it's a word salad, a pedophilia. I mean, come on, guys, okay.
And Putin's there stopping it, but our news doesn't bring that out. Do you know anything about that?
Well, you mentioned four things, so blame on a pedophile. I don't know whether there's anything special about Ukraine and pedophile. But I do know that human trafficking, and not just sex trafficking, but human trafficking for economic slavery, is an internet. It's bad in the United States, but it's worse internationally. And so I suppose that there's some of that in Ukraine, but I can't say that it's worse there than other places. And then what did you bring up about
biolabs, the financing that's he stopped over there, and then the neo-Nazis in Ukraine?
Well, the financing hasn't stopped because Congress appropriated $14 billion, seven for humanitarian and seven for military. So you maybe you just saw on television that.
No, I don't watch television.
Okay.
No, he's getting his news exclusively from Facebook. He doesn't watch TV.
But you smiled when I said that the funding,
the biolabs, but I mean the deep state funding over here.
Oh, it's now deep state. I see.
Is that going back to Biden when he was vice president? Is that what you're talking about?
Maybe. Do you know anything about that?
I've been briefed on the lab, something that was set up in the...
So, you know, Chuck Grassley is kind of taking this piece by piece, but really the problem here is, sir, you've fallen for a package of claims individually, each of which is not what you've been told. Is there trafficking in Ukraine? Yes, there's a problem with trafficking in Eastern Europe, but the problem is in Russia as well. And Putin's invasion of Ukraine is no more justified because Ukraine also has trafficking. The biolabs thing. The biolabs in Ukraine are not unique. They're not particularly pernicious. There's nothing special about them. The U.S. is part of a consortium that funds research all over the world. There's many labs in Europe. Some of them are in Ukraine. Deep state. Well, what are you talking about? It's almost like there's a it's like a starter pack of conspiracy beliefs where it's like a word salad. It just comes out of them almost like they've taken some kind of conspiratorial ayahuasca and everything is just being come. It's just you can't stop it. They're just vomiting it out into a bucket the way many on ayahuasca do. This is an example of it's never just one conspiracy theory. And this is what we've been talking about for a long time. I would have loved to have seen from Chuck Grassley. Remember this moment when during the 2008 presidential campaign, a woman said to John McCain, the late Senator John McCain, who was the presidential candidate, Obama's a Muslim and he's an Arab. And McCain said, no, he's not. Now, I would have loved to have seen in this clip, it's also OK to be Muslim in this country. But OK. Chuck Grassley not exactly living up to this standard.
I can't trust Obama. I have read about him, and he's an Arab. He is not.
No, ma'am. He's a decent family man, citizen that I just happen to have disagreements with on fundamental issues.
Right, and also, if he was an Arab. Or Muslim, as people would say at the time sometimes, you're allowed to be Muslim and president in the United States. I mean, we haven't had one. Okay, but you actually are allowed to do it. So Chuck Grassley not even living up to that standard. But this stuff is dangerous. And the Republican Party, by and large, at least welcomes it by looking the other way. Let me know your thoughts. You can find me on Twitter at @DPacman. The David Pakman Show continues to depend on you to fund what we do. We have a membership program at joinpakman.com, and I would love for you to sign up. We do an extra show every day for our members, and you can use the code WOW22 to save a surprising amount off of the cost of a membership. We have yet another example now of failed former President Donald Trump being given the opportunity to just cleanly condemn the Russian President Vladimir Putin and his invasion of Ukraine, and he doesn't do it. Last night, the former failed president was interviewed by Fox News propagandist Sean Hannity. And in a moment, we're going to get to some of this windmill stuff. Trump's still very confused about windmills, and we're going to do a little bit of a deeper dive into windmills and birds. But before we get to that, here's the opportunity. Hannity just says, is this evil? Just tease up an easy one for Trump to condemn Putin, and Trump doesn't. Delivering another one of these word salads. Take a listen to this.
I asked you the last time you were on whether you think that this is evil in our time. Do you believe this is evil in our time?
Right.
I think in 100 years, people are going to look back and they're going to say, how did we stand back and NATO stand back?
So that's a criticism of NATO and of Biden. Understand, Hannity says, is this evil? Is Putin evil? Is what Russia's doing evil? And he goes, the history books are not going to look kindly at NATO and the United States and Biden. Now, also remember, well, let's play a little more.
In many ways, I've called a paper tiger. Don't forget, I rebuilt NATO because when I became president, the first thing I noticed when I went there to the first meeting was that most of the countries were not paying or were paying far less than they were supposed to. There were only 8 out of 28 countries that were paid in full. The United States was not only one of them. We were making up the deficit in order to protect Europe. We were paying possibly 80% of NATO to protect them. And then they take advantage of us yet on trade, because on trade, They're every bit as bad as China. They treated us very badly on trade. We changed a lot of that around, but they were very tough on trade. I asked Angela Merkel, how many Chevrolets?
Guys, remember, the question was, is it evil what Putin is doing? And Trump's criticizing NATO, implicitly criticizing Biden for not doing enough, and now criticizing Angela Merkel.
Are you selling this month in Munich or Berlin? And she looked at me, well, probably none. I said, you're exactly right, none. And yet we had the Mercedes-Benz and the Volkswagens and all of them. We had all of the German companies. And the same thing with farmers. Our farmers sell virtually nothing to Europe. You take a look at...
How crazy is that? I mean, really, how bonkers is that? Is Putin's invasion evil? Why aren't American cars being sold in Germany? That's really bad. And NATO's bad, and Biden's bad. And by the way, Trump seems obsessed with why you don't see people driving around in Chevys in Germany. Guys, I hate to be critical of American industry, but like, if you can get a Volkswagen locally produced, if you can get a Mercedes or an Audi locally produced, why are you going to say, get me an American Chevy? I mean, Germany has very good cars. Like it's anyway. So another opportunity to just plainly, cleanly criticize Putin's invasion, and Trump doesn't do it. Now, there was another really wacky moment in this interview, which is not getting as much attention. Listen to what Donald Trump had to say about bald eagles, as he says, being killed by windmills. Trump is very much against wind farms. He says the noise causes cancer, not true. And listen to what he had to say.
Windmills, because they're killing eagles. They're killing the bald eagle and other eagles and other birds. And we have these windmills all over the place, and the environmentalists pretend they love them, but they're really hurting our country. They're driving down values. They're just absolutely killing us. One of the most expensive forms of energy. The turbines are all made in China or Germany, so they get the advantage of that. It's just ridiculous, but the real problem.
Yeah. So this has been studied, and this Trump has been repeating this for years, and many on the right have been repeating this about wind farms. Do windmills kill some birds? Yes, they do. They do. Windmills kill from about 230,000 to 330,000 birds per year. Wow. Okay. Well, that's significant, right? Well, maybe. Cell and radio towers cause nearly 7 million bird deaths per year. Whoa, wait a second. The wind farms kill 250,000, call it, and the cell and radio towers kill 7 million? Yes. And they never talk about that. Cats, okay? I know a lot of cat owners don't like this. Cats kill 1.4 to 3.7 billion birds a year. Billion. With a B, okay? So windmills are having no statistically significant effect on the bird population. But you know what? Maybe I'm being unfair because I'm comparing bird deaths from an energy generation mechanism to other types of bird deaths. Okay, well, if you consider the oil and gas fields kill 500,000 to a million birds per year already, and you never hear about it. Okay, so this is a completely hypocritical talking point. Everything we do has an effect. Do you wear cotton? Cotton requires a lot of water. The water that goes to make cotton clothing leads to frogs and salamanders dying because they have no environment anymore. The water is gone. Okay, I mean, so then we'll maybe switch to synthetic clothing. Oh, but those are oil derivatives in many cases, and then you've got the birds killed. These things are complicated, but one thing we know for sure is that the bird death toll from windmills is statistically insignificant compared to all the other things that we have in industry that are killing birds. Now, in terms of eagles, there's really no specific data on how many bald eagles are being killed by wind turbines. The estimate is that in total, about 100 eagles a year die from wind turbines. In theory, some of the 100 are bald eagles. I don't know. It depends. You'd have to look more. We don't have that data. But way more eagles die from other things humans do. If you care about the eagles, do you know how many eagles die from hitting cars? Do you know how many eagles die from eating leftover lead I don't know if it's called buckshot or just shot, you know, ordnance of sort, ammunition, spent, used it. Eagles eat it and then they die. Or eagles hitting electrified power lines. Well, shouldn't we be burying power lines? Oh, no, that's too expensive. We can't do that. So this is nonsense. It's nonsense. But as is often the case, there's like a tiny, somewhere there's like a tiny little kernel of something true about it. And then they fixate on it and then they blow it up and then they repeat it uncritically. So a very strange interview there with Sean Hannity. I don't want to spend a ton of time on this because I believe there's going to be more time for it. But one of the big questions about 2024 is Joe Biden going to run for re-election? I think he's not. That's my opinion as of right now. I could be wrong. It's just a guess. I'm terrible at making predictions. I thought Hillary would win in 2016. So it's just my opinion and it doesn't really matter. I just don't think Joe Biden's running for re-election in 2024. The other side of that is Trump running for re-election in 2024? I have been leaning very heavily towards yes for a while. When I interviewed Michael Cohen, Trump's former lawyer, Michael Cohen said, I don't think Trump's going to run because he's going to realize he can't win and his ego can't handle another loss. Okay, that's another opinion. But one of the things I've been mentioning is I am unsure what Trump's health is going to look like in 2024. But he's not a healthy guy and he's not a particularly young guy. Okay, just it's just actuarial realities. Fair. For the first time that I've ever seen, Donald Trump is now starting to talk about his health as a possible reason that he wouldn't run. And the question is, regardless of the truth about his health, is he just starting to lay the groundwork for using health as an excuse not to run? This is from an interesting interview in The Washington Post with Josh Dossie. This was from a few days ago. The article is called Trump Deflects Blame for January 6th Silence, Says He Wanted to March to the Capitol. I don't want to talk about that part of it. I want to talk specifically about the end of this article where Trump actually talks about the issue of 2024 and health. Check this out. Let's put it up on the screen. Trump said it was true. He had told advisors that his health would factor into whether he would run again in 2024, but that he was currently in good health. Quote, you always have to talk about health. You look like you're in good health, but tomorrow you get a letter from a doctor saying, come see me again. That's not good when they use the word again. So this is typical Trump speak where we're like left wondering, is he saying this because he already knows about a health issue or not? Or does he just, what is this about? It's cryptic. It's always completely cryptic. But this is the first time I'm aware of that Donald Trump has floated what will his health status be in 2024 as a factor. Now, I've been saying it's a factor. Obviously, if he's not healthy, he's not going to be able to run. But Trump is now laying it out there. And there's two perspectives. One is there's something going on with Trump, and this is how he's starting to allude to it. The second perspective is this is just setting up an excuse, but Trump has no intention of running. What Trump wants to do is to continue dangling that he might run the way he's been doing at rallies, saying you're going to be very happy in 2024. We're going to take it back in 2024, suggesting that he's going to run in order to keep fundraising for his PAC, which is pretty clearly being used as a slush fund to hire family members and who knows what else. He has millions of reasons right now to pretend that he's going to run in 2024, and he may not even really be planning to do it. We just don't know. What we do know is health, which I've been talking about for over a year now, actually being mentioned by Trump, as far as I know, for the first time. We'll have more coverage of this interview on our Instagram at David Pakman Show, and you can let us know there in a comment. What do you think is the meaning of this health issue being brought up by Trump for the first time? Let us know. It's great to have back on the show today Nick Majuli, who is the COO at Ritholtz Wealth Management, also founder of Dollars and Data, a data-focused personal finance blog, and also author of the new book, Just Keep Buying, Proven Ways to Save Money and Build Your Wealth. Nick, the book is killing on Amazon. It's crazy what's going on.
I appreciate it. Yeah, it's been a crazy few days so far.
So, you know, one of the questions I often get from my viewers is, are financial advisors a scam? And what I try to explain is, at the individual level, no, the answer is no. I mean, sure, there are financial advisors whose practices are scammy, and there's financial advisors that are not. But what I say the scam is that the financial services industry has sold the idea to people that basic personal finance is really complicated and you can't handle it yourself. And what you do in your book is you explain in really clear terms the most important, you know, 8 to 10 principles about managing money. And you really explain that it's not as complicated as maybe the industry wants you to believe. Is that fair?
Yeah, I think that's true at times. I mean, obviously, it depends on your situation. And I think that when financial planning makes the most sense is the more complex it gets, especially with taxes. So usually, I think for most people, it doesn't make sense to be paying a fee if you don't have a lot of assets. It's very simple. I mean, unless you just want the peace of mind. And so that's what a lot of people really, that, you know, I work in the wealth management industry, full disclosure.
Of course.
That's what a lot of people come to us for, is for the peace of mind. It's not necessarily like, you know, it's not that they couldn't do it themselves. A lot of times there's like, I don't want to do it. I'm going to spend my time doing something more valuable. And I think that's why for a lot of people, it's worth the price they pay.
One of the things that you talk about in the book, and you back it up with data, is kind of the futility of this idea of, when should I be investing? When is the right time to sort of get in and to get out? And this is something I've talked to my audience about a lot. And every time that the markets are shaky, and we saw this in March of 2020 at the start of the pandemic, we've seen it over the last 2 months. So many people, you look at Twitter, you look at Reddit, you look at all these different places, they're saying, I'm going to give it 5 more days, or I'm going to wait, or this isn't exactly the right time. Aside from anyone's opinions about their ability to predict the future, which is not very good, where humans are not particularly good at that, lay out the statistical case for why it doesn't really make sense to be doing that.
Yeah. So if you're trying to wait, so waiting to like buy a dip is one thing, and then just waiting at all is usually a bad idea. And the reason why is because most of the time markets, you know, generally increase over time. And of course, there's going to be cases where markets crash and things like that. But, you know, if you're going to compare someone who's trying to, even if, you know, I use in the book, chapter 14, it's called Even God Couldn't Beat Dollar Cost Averaging. And I basically say, I'm going to tell you when the dips are, and you're just going to save cash and buy those dips, like the lowest point between two all-time highs, like on a monthly basis. And that strategy actually underperforms someone who just buys every month, like 80% of the time. And the reason why is because by the time you wait for that big dip, by the time it happens, that price, that dip price is higher than where you could have bought originally, right? So you're like, you're always ended up buying at a higher price. And so there's always gonna be reasons to sell. Like you always can, you know, psych yourself out about this stuff. And don't get me wrong, sometimes people are gonna move to cash and they're gonna be right once in a while, right? And they're gonna be right in the short run. But I think the behavioral reason why you shouldn't do it is you're gonna be wrong in the long run, right? If imagine every time, you know, imagine in after 2009, you're like, wow, I'm gonna stay out of the market for a while. 2010, 2011, you stay out, you're like, wow, look, I'm smart or whatever. Markets recovered a little bit, but then you stay out for the next 5-10 years and you miss one of the biggest bull markets in history, right? And that's what's happened. There's been people saying the stock market's been overvalued since 2012, 2013, and the market's been on an upward tear since. So one day they'll be right, but they're gonna be wrong most of the time, and that's the issue here.
The other concern I would have with such a strategy, and many of my friends do this stuff, and I tell them, I think you're wasting your time, is that I'm big on systematizing what I'm trying to do with my finances. And even if you believe that you would be really good at figuring out, okay, we've hit the bottom, now is the time to start buying again, it's not a systematic approach. And the systematic approach has the advantages, number one, of being, in my mind, far less stressful and anxiety causing. Number two, if you continue your investment plan on the way down, you're actually getting more value for your money, in the sense that $100 buys you more shares when the market is down than when the market is up. And thirdly, and correct me if I'm wrong, you're continuing to accumulate dividends during that time. And somebody who is just waiting is not going to be doing that. So it seems that the systematic aspect has both psychological and financial benefits.
Yeah, I completely agree. And so the whole, like, my argument is like, you know, do something better with your time, right? Like David, I think you're probably better suited to be, you know, hosting a YouTube show and talking about this than spending, you know, 5-10 hours a week looking at your investments, right? If you think about the return you're going to get on your personal human capital, and for someone else that may be like, oh, I'm a photography person, like maybe you should do more photo shoots, or someone, you know, is a writer and so they should write more blog posts, whatever it is, whatever you do, like I bet there's some higher value activity you have than going and invest and doing that stuff with your money, especially if you don't have a lot of money invested. If you have $10,000 invested, right? Let's say you can, you know, increase your returns by, you know, let's say 10%, right? That's $1,000. And let's say you spend 10 hours a week doing that over the course of, a year, right? So let's say 10 times, you know, 50, it's 500. You spend 500 hours to make $1,000. Like, think about that. Like, it's so silly. Like, you would, no, you should literally just get a part-time job. You'd make way more money, right? So it's one of those things when you start thinking about the math on it, you're like, wow, my hourly wage of doing this doesn't make any sense. You know, if you have $10 million, that's a little different, but, you know, most of us don't. So
when it comes to debt, there's some interesting parts of the book about, you talk about mortgages, you talk about debt in different ways. Debt is very polarizing, and I don't mean necessarily politically polarizing. I'm not talking about the national debt. I'm talking about personal debt, people's decisions about credit cards, as well as people's decisions about mortgages. And very commonly, you'll hear strategies espoused. If I understand correctly, Christian financial guy Dave Ramsey talks about starting with, I don't remember if it's the smallest debt or the highest interest debt first. Everybody has some algorithm that they will sometimes apply. What's often missing mm-hmm. from those conversations are the sort of psychological impacts of having the debt. And so when people sometimes have called, I guess they call me because my background was in financial planning, although I haven't been in that space for 15 years. They'll say, should one pay off a mortgage if you have the cash to do it? And you can run the numbers calculating what's your mortgage interest deduction and what's the interest rate. You can do all that. But at the end of the day, there's an intangible, which is like psychologically, what is having the debt do for your day to day? And that can be much harder to kind of wrap our minds around, can it not?
Yeah, I think some of the data on that's interesting. So the only debt that didn't have any sort of psychological impact, at least on average across the population, was mortgage debt. That's the only, every other debt messes with people. If you have credit card debt, that's usually stressful. If you have other type medical debt, whatever, that usually affects people's psyche. They found that mortgage debt generally doesn't affect people. However, there is a subset of the population that doesn't feel comfortable with any debt, and that's fine. And so you're not going to want to hold debt at all. So even there's people, like, I know people very smart in the financial space, and they paid off their homes despite the fact that they had like a 3% interest rate, you know, and they did that because they just want the peace of mind. And so for some people, peace of mind is going to be better than all that other stuff. And so just, you have to think about that, you know, when you're making these types of financial decisions. So there's nothing wrong with it, but just, you kind of have to know yourself, right? This is almost a story as old as time. This is like a philosophical point that's been around for thousands of years, like, know thyself, right? Like, so once you know kind of what you like and don't like, that's how you can make better decisions with your money.
When it comes to timing and real estate, are the principles different than when it comes to timing the stock market, in the sense of, if you have a need for housing, you can choose to buy or you can choose to rent. And very often rents will reflect the cost to whoever ultimately owns the property in which you're going to live. So there's a correlation there, although it may not be perfect all of the time. Sometimes people who already own a place say, well, I'd like to move, but I want to wait until the property is worth more. But then in all likelihood, the property you're looking to buy will also have increased in value, mm-hmm. unless you've got maybe some market arbitrage because you're looking to move or something like that. How does the timing mm-hmm. piece affect the purchase of property?
So yeah, I think because like so if you're saying like, oh, I'm going to buy like a REIT, right? You're going to put money into like a REIT fund that has, you're owning a broad basket of, you know, commercial properties or whatever, commercial and residential properties across the US. I think timing is not going to matter that much. I mean, obviously there will be ebbs and flows in the market overall. However, when you're buying an individual property, timing matters a lot, because you can, the corollary in the stock market is like going from buying the S&P 500 index fund to just buying Apple. You're buying one individual property is like buying a single stock, right? So you have single stock risk in your individual home. So like, of course, timing is going to matter in the sense that there's a lot more risk when you buy an individual stock or an individual property. So like, there's no real great way around that, right? You're going to have to take that individual stock risk, so to speak, with that individual property. And so like, yes, timing is going to matter. And you're right that like other properties will go up in value too. So you just got to figure out like, hey, is this the right time for me? And don't try to look at it as an investment. I think when you buy a home, it needs to be something more for your personal life, societal reasons why you're doing it. Maybe your personal life's stable now, you have a few kids or whatever, and you know, like, hey, this is the neighborhood I want to be in, this is everything I want, and you just move. And I think if you think about it as an investment, it's going to be really tough for you, because your home should not be, I mean, it can be an investment, but you can't eat the equity. Your home price could double. You can't do anything about that. And especially if you move to another home, you end up selling that home, buying another one. What did you actually earn? Nothing, right? If all the prices move. So you can't eat your equity, unfortunately, until you do some sort of arbitrage, like you said, like the Californians moving to Idaho and et cetera, right? So
we've talked about stocks, we've talked about real estate, cryptocurrency, cryptocurrency, there are so many opinions, many of them informed, many of them not informed, many of them misinformed on cryptocurrency. My view on cryptocurrency has been, I want some upside exposure there. And so years and years ago, as we've talked about before, I got some Bitcoin and some Ethereum. And I kind of determined, given its volatility, what's the right asset allocation for me? And for me, it's about 3% of my total assets. And so if it goes to zero, I lose 3% of my total assets. At this point, it has grown so much and I've sold pieces of it that even if it went to zero, I come out ahead. But the point is, I'm thinking of the volatility in determining what is my right exposure in terms of asset allocation. Is this the right approach when you are dealing with a relatively new and volatile asset?
Yes, I completely agree with that. I actually did some analysis and I found like the optimal portfolio had like 2% Bitcoin, and that's basically what my crypto allocation's been. So 3-2%, some go up to 5, you know. I think that's very prudent. I don't think there's much to add. I think you almost had a perfect answer there. So
let's then go in this direction. There seems to be a sort of moral assessment done with crypto that isn't always done with stock holdings, which I find interesting. Like, for example, when I hold a total stock market index fund, there are absolutely companies in there that are probably not great companies. There's, statistically speaking, there's companies in there that are committing fraud, securities fraud of some kind. There's the full kind of gamut. But I don't find myself emotionally tied to that in the way that sometimes people make very emotional reactions to Bitcoin or Ethereum. What do you think it is that causes some, at least, to view these things so differently?
I think there's just so much fanaticism on both sides. So I think like the pro crypto people are so pro crypto, they can only see that way. And most of them, I think, have like a very, very large percentage of their assets in crypto. It's gone up a lot. So they are going to be biased. And then there's people on the other side who weren't in on it, and they think it's a big scam and it's worthless and all this stuff. And they're going to be biased in their own ways. And I think it's really tough to have a balanced view on this, because you're going to bring some bias in. I'm saying I own some crypto. I think I'm trying to do it in a prudent way, but you know, I'm not perfect on it, but I'm probably slightly biased against it only because it's not income producing. And so I kind of talk about that in the book, like income producing assets should be the bulk of your wealth, which is like stocks, bonds, real estate, things that actually, you know, actually produce income. Now bonds obviously have done terribly recently, but for most of history, they've been decent. So, you know, there's a lot of talk about reducing bond allocation. So, and that I think makes sense.
Last thing I want to talk about, in terms of all the signals that people can pay attention to, if you have a systematic plan, an asset allocation, and you just do that every month, it seems to me that there would be very little financial news that you would really need to pay attention to in terms of like what's actionable. So let me just throw a few things out there and you tell me whether these things even really matter to the average investor. More and more articles now talk about, when the yield curve inverts, it signals a coming recession. That's like one that is out there and it's very popular. Or when the CAPE ratio goes above or below a certain place, it signals that, okay, so all these different things. Aside from whether these are accurate, does it really matter to the average investor if you have a systematic plan? Because I'm not seeing how you would change your behavior, even if some of these metrics were accurate predictors.
Well, so the yield curve inversion is a pretty decent predictor of recession. And so if you actually look at the data after an inversion, like, yes, stock returns are lower. The problem is what are your options? You're like, oh, I'll just move to bonds. Well, guess what? Bonds underperform stocks even after yield curve inversion. So like you don't really have a choice. You just kind of have to like deal with a terrible situation. And that's probably what at some point, you know, assuming history repeats itself, it doesn't always, like the August 29 inversion didn't lead to a recession. I mean, people say, oh, there was a recession, COVID, you know, 2020. But I'm going to argue that the yield curve inversion 2019 was not predicting the COVID. You know, let's be honest here. The COVID didn't exist then. So,
yeah.
So you see my point. My point is, though, these things happen and they are predictive of lower returns. Even like higher CAPE is predictive of lower returns, or future returns. I agree with that. The problem is, what are your options? What are you going to do? You can try and move to cash in time, but the CAPE's been at 30 since 2017. The market's doubled since then. Like, what? You're going to be sitting in cash while the market's doubled, and you're just right now you're eating 8% inflation. You're done. So like, you kind of have to just go on this wild ride, and there's no real options you have. You know,
The book is Just Keep Buying: Proven Ways to Save Money and Build Your Wealth. The book is listed at davidpakman.com/finance. When you can see my other finance books recommendations. We've been speaking with the book's author, Nick Majuli. Nick, always great speaking with you. Thanks.
Thanks, David. Appreciate it.
One of the things we've learned to pay special attention to over the last few years is when the American Republican Party says, this is what the left is going to do, we should look really carefully at whether what they mean is we're actually already doing this. And when it comes to voter fraud, we've increasingly learned that all of the fear-mongering and all of the allegations about what Democrats and the left are going to do was actually stuff that almost exclusively it was Republicans doing. People voting twice, people voting in the names of dead people, all of these different things. We see endless instances on the right. And Donald Trump's former chief of staff, Mark Meadows, is now really caught in the crosshairs. I recently told you guys that Meadows is under investigation for, was he registered to vote where he actually lived? There's some really fishy stuff going on. And the latest news is that Mark Meadows has indeed now been removed from the North Carolina voter rolls in the middle of this investigation. Axios reporting, former White House chief of staff Mark Meadows was removed from North Carolina's voter roll Monday. Why it matters. The move comes amid an investigation into Meadows for alleged voter fraud related to his voter registration. The probe followed reports which revealed that Meadows registered to vote in North Carolina in September 2020 using an address he allegedly never visited. State of play. Meadows was removed from the North Carolina voter roll after documentation indicated, he lived in Virginia and last voted in the 2021 election there. No formal challenge has been received by the Macon County Board of Elections. The last election he voted in Macon County was 2020. Under state law, if a North Carolina voter exercises the right of a citizen by voting in an election in another state, the person is considered to have lost their North Carolina residence. Now, there's two issues here. Remember, Republicans kept talking about people registered to vote in two places. That's not against the law as long as you don't vote in two places. It's very common that somebody lives in one place and you register, and then you move somewhere else and you register there. You're not automatically removed from the registration at the old place. You're registered in two places. I believe Tiffany Trump, Trump's daughter, had this going on. As long as you don't vote twice, it's okay. You haven't actually done anything wrong. The next part with the Mark Meadows investigation is the address where he was supposedly registered to vote, or where he was registered to vote, where he supposedly lived, was not a place he had allegedly even been to. If I recall correctly, it was a trailer of some kind, and the circumstances are all extraordinarily bizarre. Now, it shouldn't come like as a complete and total shock to us that this is really common. But also remember that Donald Trump multiple times talked about you should try voting twice. This all of this vote by mail thing, it's so complicated that maybe you should try voting twice. Here's just one time that Donald Trump said this. Mark Meadows was Trump's chief of staff at this time.
Sign your mail-in ballot, okay? You sign it.
Right.
And send it in, and then you have to follow it. And if on election day or early voting that is not tabulated and counted, you go vote. And then if for some reason after that, it shouldn't take that long, it comes in, they're not going to be able to tabulate it because you will have voted. But you have to make sure your vote counts, because the only way they're going to beat us is by doing that kind of stuff.
So Trump said, even if you submit a mail-in vote, you should still go and try to vote again, because if they don't receive it, but what he's saying is try to vote twice, try to vote twice. And of course, it all is predicated on the idea that the mail-in votes are going to just end up some kind of netherworld, some kind of election purgatory of sorts. But remember, they never actually cared about voter fraud. They never really cared about it. They care about what are the ways in which they can weaponize confusion and misinformation to help themselves win. They want to use voter fraud as an issue to make it harder to vote. And that includes closing polling places, reducing early voting hours, reducing vote by mail, doing all of the things that make it harder to vote strategically, only in certain places. Notice that they don't really care about this in California. They don't care about this in Massachusetts. They don't care about this in Connecticut. They care about it in places where they can think to themselves, okay, let's evaluate the electorate and evaluate policy. And if it's a state that could be close, let's see what kind of disinformation we can push or what kind of laws we could seek to have changed that would maybe give us a little bit of an edge or at least give us the opportunity to later challenge it. That's another part of it, because sometimes we hear, oh, well, it's not clear that closing polling places in Michigan would help them in the sense that you might close polling places in Michigan and it makes it harder for Democrats and Republicans to vote. Okay, maybe. First of all, typically they argue for polling places to be closed in urban areas that have more Democratic voters. They'll say, there's too many polling places. We don't need this many polling places. So that makes it harder for Democratic-leaning areas to vote. But the other part of it is they just want to create a pretext to then later challenge votes. And making changes to where and when and how you can vote creates a pretext that then you can use to say, things didn't go right, we're filing a lawsuit or we're filing a complaint of some kind. What else did we have? I mean, these are really the main things. And as always, if they keep saying the left is going to do this, it probably means they're already doing it. I think some of you are going to find this pretty funny. One of the things that, by the way, speaking of projection, one of the things the right criticizes the left for is this idea that anything goes, any opinion is valid, and they call it a form of postmodernism, where everyone is supposed to get an equal seat at the table and we have to listen to all opinions and value them and consider them all equally. Now, it's not true. It's not true. But as is often the case, it is they who are doing the very thing which they accuse others of doing. We call this projection. Charlie Kirk, a right-wing ideologue who speaks overwhelmingly to college-age people and tries to convince them to become right-wingers, he is now saying inflation may be caused by trans people, by transgender people. If I've ever seen an example of this sort of pseudo-postmodern, every opinion is valid, everything is connected sort of thing, it's this. Take a listen to this. This is beyond words.
So one of the reasons why we take such a strong stance and opinion on the trans issue
right.
is it's an issue of reality.
Mm.
You do not get to determine your own reality. You do not get to all of a sudden say, I'm rich or I'm poor. No, we actually have to look at some evidence of whether or not you're rich or poor. Now, some of those are relative terms. Rich according to who? Rich according to what? I understand that. But relatively, some of the terms we use, short, tall, you can't just make them up. You say, oh, wow, that person is taller than that person. That person is faster than that person.
Fair.
That person is stronger than that person.
So far, so good.
And one of the reasons why we've been so insistent against this idea you can change your gender or change your sex or change both of them is that when you start to indulge in the belief that you could become whatever you want and reality is subjective, not objective, you're going to have ramifications that nobody anticipated or intended.
Okay.
So there is a direct connection to inflation and the trans issue.
Wow.
I say, Charlie, come on, they couldn't be further apart. No, they're exactly the same. They're the same in this aspect. When you believe that men can become women, why wouldn't you also believe that you could print wealth?
Oh, man. Is it? That's rich, isn't it? Isn't that there's about seven things that have to be unpacked there.
If you believe that someone can change their gender, why wouldn't you also believe that money is wealth? Now, there are very simple laws of economics, just like there's laws of nature, those laws of physics, laws of thermodynamics, laws of biology. We must live according to those laws.
What's really funny about this is so I'm going to interpret what he's saying. He says that the ideology that one can pick their gender leads to inflation insofar as saying you can pick your gender is like saying you can print money without causing inflation. Neither is true, but that both are sort of magical, imaginary beliefs not based in reality. If you believe one, you're likely to believe the other. If you believe anyone can pick their gender, you believe you can just increase the money supply with no effect, and you're likely to do it. The people who believe you can pick your gender are more likely to believe you can increase the money supply with no effect. And the problem with this is it's so absurd that it's hard to even discuss it on its merits. But the general principle that applies here is projection, because I could turn this around. This doesn't lead to productive discussion, is the point I'm trying to make. I could turn this around and go, listen, Charlie, you know, the idea that you cut taxes for the rich and it helps the economy, that's just imaginary. That's just as imaginary as anything else. And you can just link two things. You can just link any two things. Listen, if vaccines are related to trickle-down economics. David, what? What are you talking about? Yeah, I mean, listen, if the belief that the vaccine doesn't work is just as imaginary as the belief that cutting taxes for the rich is good for the economy. Oh, okay, I've just linked them. Does this actually substantively improve our understanding of either of those issues, vaccination or taxation? No, it doesn't. And similarly, Charlie Kirk saying, well, the idea that people can believe things that aren't true can be used to link any two issues. It doesn't mean there's actually a connection between trans and inflation. What's the purpose of this, though? The purpose is to start grouping ideas they don't like together, even if they don't actually have any business being grouped together, with the idea of convincing people by saying, well, if you believe either of these things, you have to believe the other. They must both be wrong, so I should reject both beliefs. That's the idea. It's to weaponize the anti-trans people when it comes to the economy under Biden, or the other way around, to weaponize the economy under Biden to convince people that they shouldn't be for people being able to live in the way that aligns with the way that they feel. So it's bogus. It doesn't lead to anything productive, but this is the Ben Shapiro type stuff that you go to a college campus and people hear and they go, wow, Charlie's making a lot of sense there. It really makes a lot of sense. It's their version of the anything goes postmodernism that they say exists exclusively on the left. And they're not going to stop because this works. He goes to college campuses and he says this stuff and people just donate. They just give him money. They give him money, money, money. It's extremely profitable. It's extremely effective. And it's extraordinarily depressing. We have a voicemail number. That number is 2192-DAVID-P. Here is a voicemail which argues, this is actually very interesting, that what Putin is doing is no different than what American settlers did to the Native Americans of the United States. Take a listen to this.
Have you gotten any street smarts yet?
No.
Have you figured out what the difference is between what Putin's doing and what our forefathers did when they came here and they just killed everybody for the property that was here?
Okay.
You know, like the indigenous people. There's no fucking difference. Do you honestly understand the United States? There are no United States. There's 50 different fucking countries in North America. They do whatever the fuck they want, and the government doesn't do a goddamn thing. And we're supposed to be the United States. Are you fucking kidding me? Are you that fucking naive?
So the person does seem unhinged, but part of the argument that he seems to be making is what Putin is doing in Ukraine is no more right or wrong than what our forefathers did in the United States. Well, I mean, listen, circumstances are different, but there's a grain of truth to that. If someone had been able to stop our forefathers, they probably would have. And so the fact that the people who came from Europe to colonize the United States were able to do it because they didn't meet enough resistance isn't a very good reason to say what Putin is doing isn't really that bad or should be allowed to go on. Maybe the guy's making a good point. But when I hear that, I say, oh, well, I mean, if the natives had been better equipped, they might have rejected the colonial settlers from Europe. That's not a reason to let Putin take whatever the hell he wants. Kind of an interesting, I mean, a very angry person, very unhinged, but making an interesting point that I think should be considered, but maybe considered in a different way than he wants me thinking about it. Interesting stuff. We have a fantastic bonus show for you today. Iowa and New Hampshire are not guaranteed to be the first primaries of 2024. We'll tell you what's going on and why. We will also talk about the extension to the federal travel mask mandate, which applies on planes and elsewhere. And lastly, Governor Greg Abbott of Texas doing quite a stunt with a bus of migrants going to Washington, D.C. We'll tell you what's going on and what they hope to get out of it. All of those stories and more on today's bonus show. Sign up.
WRCT in sound from way out.
Depose from the faint. Do you think I'm hot? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
Hey there, folks. Glad you could join me for all the best, the smoothest of the smooth, the cool and gentle sounds of what we call jazz.
Tired of the fluffy stuff? At WRCT Pittsburgh, jazz is a once-over.
Holocaust. It's a very serious problem, and one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after your sorry corpse has evaporated in a blinding flash of light and heat. I hope this thought comforts you. WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Now and forever.
For those of you concerned with your health and the new USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all our DJs are genetically modified to bring you best music.
Yo, what's up? How y'all doing out there in Technoland? RCT Techno DJs in the house. Oh yeah, bringing you the only fat beats Pittsburgh, right here on WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Word to your mother.
Hello, my fellow Americans. I would just like to say now, as an expert on the subject, that WRCT Pittsburgh does not blow. Thank you.
RCT Pittsburgh, meaty and full of flavor since 1949.
Would you like to take the sounds of your favorite radio station to places you never thought possible? Well, now you can, because WRCT is live on the internet. Just point your browser to www.wrct.org and click on our live MP3 broadcast. Now you can go out of town without any feelings of loss or regret for leaving us behind, because we're just a mouse click away. WRCT, live on the internet. Because why should Pittsburgh have all the fun?
Nuclear Holocaust. It's a very serious problem, and one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after your sorry corpse has evaporated in a blinding flash of light and heat. I hope this thought comforts you. WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Now and forever.
For those of you concerned with your health and the new USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all our DJs are genetically modified to bring you best music.
Was represented Raytheon, BAE Systems, Lockheed Martin, Huntington Ingalls, General Dynamics, and Northrop Grumman were all represented today.
As the Pentagon meets with the nation's largest weapons contractors, Russia's warned the Biden administration to stop arming Ukraine, claiming it's adding fuel to the conflict. This comes as a Russian warship sinks in the Black Sea, hours after Ukraine claimed to have attacked it with cruise missiles. We'll speak to William Hartung, then look at how the war is reverberating across the globe.
End this war. But this war will not end merely in Ukraine. The entire war must be ended. No more seeking to defeat near-peer rivals. This is the worst kind of macho idealism, the idea that the United States can be dominant forever.
We'll speak to Vijay Prashad. And as a judge orders the suspected New York subway gunman held without bail, we'll speak to Mother Jones editor Mark Fulman, author of the new book Trigger Points, Inside the Mission to Stop Mass Shootings in America. All that and more coming up. Rush, welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Russia's military says the flagship of its Black Sea fleet, the guided missile cruiser Moskva, which stands for Moscow, sank as it was being towed to port Thursday, forcing some 500 sailors to abandon ship. The loss of the Moskva was reported hours after Ukraine's military claimed it had successfully attacked the warship with cruise missiles. Russia contends the ship was damaged after a fire caused ammunition on board to explode. This comes as the Washington Post is reporting the Russian government has formally warned the Biden administration to stop arming Ukraine, claiming it's adding fuel to the conflict. Russia has warned the governments of Finland and Sweden against joining NATO, saying it's prepared to station more nuclear weapons in the Baltic Sea region in response to further NATO expansion. The threat came as CIA Director William Burns told lawmakers they should not discount the threat of Russia potentially using tactical nuclear weapons in Ukraine out of desperation. We'll have more on the war in Ukraine after headlines. In occupied East Jerusalem, more than 150 people were injured after Israeli soldiers attacked Palestinian worshippers inside the Al-Aqsa Mosque shortly after morning prayers Friday. Witnesses said troops fired tear gas, rubber-coated bullets, concussion grenades into the holy site's prayer halls and courtyards.
They brutally emptied the compound. They were attacking the employees, normal people, elders, and young people. There were many people injured. They fired rubber bullets inside the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. They were beating everyone, even the paramedics.
One local hospital received 40 injured Palestinians, including two in critical condition. Israeli troops rounded up and arrested at least 300 people. The raid follows a series of attacks by Palestinians and Arab citizens of Israel that have killed people inside Israel since March 22nd. Meanwhile, Israeli raids on West Bank towns and villages have killed 29 Palestinians since March. Among the dead are a 34-year-old Palestinian lawyer who was shot in the chest Wednesday and a 14-year-old boy killed by Israeli troops who accused him of throwing a Molotov cocktail. Six United States senators have arrived in Taiwan for a surprise visit, prompting an angry response from China. The delegation says it's planning 2 days of talks on U.S.-Taiwan relations and regional security. New Jersey Democrat Bob Menendez, who chairs the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, spoke after he was welcomed by Taiwan's president.
with Taiwan producing 90% of the world's high-end semiconductor products. It is a country of global significance, of global consequence, of global impact, and therefore, it should be understood